Hey friend, welcome to Job with Julie. This is a listener-supported podcast and is an outreach of authentic intimacy. Well, did you know that the number one reason couples get divorced is because of lack of commitment? According to a study conducted by the University of Denver, lack of commitment is the most common reason cited by divorcing couples, and that beats out frequent arguments, infidelity, and even money issues. With all the ups and downs that marriages have, it can be easy to wonder in the end if fighting for your marriage is even worth it. Maybe you feel that way today. Well, in this episode, I'm sitting down with John McGee. He is the Senior Director of Watermark Resources at Watermark Community Church in Dallas, Texas, and co-creator of the Re-Engage curriculum. Now, this is a curriculum designed to help couples reconnect, reignite, and resurrect their marriages. Having been involved in marriage ministry for over 22 years, John has lots of insight to share when it comes to what couples are missing, how to steward the marital relationship, and how to find hope in marriage when it feels like there's just no way forward. But before we get to that conversation, let me ask you, did you know that we have a lot of resources at our website that are translated into Spanish? Well, if you or someone you know is looking for Spanish resources on the topic of godly sexuality, and check out some of what we have, our blogs translated into Spanish and other resources at AuthenticIntimacy.com. And if you are a single Spanish-speaking woman or know someone who speaks Spanish and may be interested in joining one of our online book studies, it's not too late. We have a Sex and the Single Girl online book study, which will be hosted entirely in Spanish, and is sure to make a great way to connect with other like-minded women on a journey to embrace and understand their sexuality in God-honoring ways. You can find links to our Spanish resources and to that online book study in our show notes. But for now, let's head to the coffee shop for my conversation with John McGee. Well, John, hey, thanks so much for having coffee with me. I look forward to chatting with you about your ministry with marriage, which kind of goes way back.
It does. Yeah. Yeah. So we've been at this, Julie, whatever the math is, about 22 years, I think. We could do a whole podcast on just that. But it's a funny story. Not what I wanted to do in any way. I wanted to do something that was really important to the kingdom of God. I wanted to plant a church. I wanted to be a missionary or teach in seminary, but like the really important things. And I was given this role as the director of marriage ministry at our new little church. And I thought, man, what a waste. I want to do something really, really important. And so you understand, obviously, the rest of the story. The next 12 years, put my head down. And as they tried to move me out of that position, I would kind of fight to the death and had flipped and say, hey, you know what? I can't imagine anything that would be more important to do with my life than to, you know, in some ways impact marriages, because, you know, oftentimes couples have kids who have kids who have kids who have had kids. And so I wanted to make sure that I didn't waste my life. And it wasn't something I asked for. It wasn't something I saw coming. It wasn't something I saw value in initially, but it has been something that I've been increasingly passionate about and really grateful for.
Mm. So I'd love to hear about how that flip happened, because I'm sure there are still some people that would think about this the way you once did, where So marriage is sort of this sideline issue that the church can address if it wants, but the real work, John, is the gospel. It's bringing people to repentance. It's, you know, discipling them to follow Jesus. So convince me that marriage work is central to what a Christian leader should be doing or what a church should be doing.
Wow. Oh my goodness. You don't have long enough. I know the allotted time we have, and you do not have long enough, friend. Let me just press play on a couple things that come to mind. So this wasn't the conversation I thought we'd have, but it's one that excites me. So a couple things. For one, obviously as a Christian, it is a litmus test of our spirituality, right? So a lot of times we tend to pick these markers. We say, boy, to really be spiritual is to, and whatever our little tribe is, it's to know the Bible really well. It's to maybe serve really well. It's to give a bunch of money. It's to be able to teach, something like that. We all kind of, whatever group we run in, we have these things that are the markers of spirituality. And, you know, Jesus said, the way the world would know that we were his disciples, we were his followers, we were doing the things he would do if he were us, is that we would love one another. And that's what he chose to say, you know, kind of at the end, would mark us. And so that would be, obviously, that would be all relationships. That would be friendships. That would be parent, child, parent to child. And then clearly, husband and wife. And so then you think about the centrality of relationships, obviously Ephesians 5 and the mirroring of Christ's love for the church. This is going to be kind of the visible picture of that. But the verse that one of the verses that's always terrified, one of the scariest verses in the Bible to me is that 1 Peter 3:7 verse, you know. And so the part A says, you know, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way. And then C says, so that your prayers will not be hindered, which is just so fascinating to me that it wasn't, hey, if you don't read your Bible, we'll hinder your prayers. Or if you don't give, or if you don't show up at church, it's the way you treat your spouse like that. You want to really upend the relationship with God that you have. You don't treat your spouse well. You don't love your spouse well. So I think I began to see the connection of that. And then, you know, Julie, as you said, it's about the gospel. Marriage, I really do think, teaches us about the gospel, and the gospel teaches us about marriage. And so when you think about all the implications of the gospel, so here's one. This verse stops me in my tracks a lot. Ephesians 2, you know, we were by very nature objects or deserving of God's wrath. So think about that. What we deserved was the wrath of God. And instead, we got mercy. And the reality is, as you know, because I'm married to another human being, both of us at times we do things. My wife, her name is Pam, and she is way more. So anything, if I give an example of the negative of what a marriage should do, Pam has a whole lot less points on her board than I do. But, you know, if I've done something that really would be deserving of wrath, it wouldn't be the same way of God's wrath. But I do some things to Pam that, you know, I don't think anybody would blame her for being wrathful. She generally gives me mercy. And the reason she can do that is because Pam deeply understands that she was an object of wrath, would have been, should have been, and instead she's received the mercy of God. So it's incongruent for us to receive a gift from God and not extend it to others. And I think oftentimes we think about forgiveness, we think about service, we think about initiation. The gospel teaches us to initiate. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Christ didn't wait for us to come to him. He didn't wait for us to get our stuff together to become worthy. He moved towards us. And so in our marriage, sometimes I don't want to move towards Pam, you know, and I know I'm positive she has lots of reasons not to move towards me. And both of us, you know, remember Romans 5:8, that while they're not being at their best, you know, I don't have to die for my spouse, but I do need to move towards them. And I can't not do that because I've been the recipient of that. So those are some off the top of the head thoughts, but yeah, reactive.
Yeah, sure. You know, I would even ask you, as you describe how love works that way and how grace works that way, you feel like that's true in all Christian relationships or primarily marriage? Is it more powerful in marriage? You know, like we could be teaching these same things to
absolutely,
you know, people that work together and family members and things like that.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. There's a few things that would be unique to marriage. And so there's something about when you sleep with a person and you raise kids with them and you sign up, you know, till death do us part, there's an intensity that surfaces the worst parts of us at times. And so we're in need of the gospel probably in unique ways when we're married. But yes, absolutely. If you've got friends, if you have coworkers, if you've got a family that you're a part of, Matthew 18, the parable of the unmerciful servant, should be both a comfort and a challenge to you because God's forgiven you deeply. And we have some you know, fellow workers in that passage who really frustrate us, and they owe us in a sense, and we want to extract justice. But if you remember the parable, that the servant had his massive debt that he couldn't repay, wiped out clean, with no terms, with no conditions. He walked out of there. He was going to, you know, be sent to jail forever to die, along with his wife and kids. And he walks out of there scot-free. Completely scot-free, and then has the audacity, you know, to put his arms around or his hands around, you know, the neck of another servant and demand repayment for a much smaller sum. And when we read that, we're at first completely appalled by that person, and then we realize, oh no, that's us. That's me. Mm-hmm. I'm the one who's been completely, completely forgiven by Christ, but I'm not so apt to give that. But I must. That's the only right response in relationships of all kinds because I've received it.
Yeah. Oh boy, John, people are saying, yeah, but that's not a marriage passage. And, you know, I think sometimes we've limited our understanding of biblical marriage by just looking at passages that specifically address husband and wife instead of saying, hey, all of these Christian truths of how we love each other well also apply. So thanks for sharing that.
You want a really hot take on that, Julie? Imagine this scenario. We wake up in an alternate universe tomorrow where all of the marriage verses are stripped out. So other than you should be married, and there's a thing as a man and there's a thing as a woman, and they get married until death do us part. Like, we understand the basic functions, but there's no real specifics. So we just scrub all of that. There is no Ephesians 5, no 1 Peter 3, any of those kinds of things. I think Christians still should absolutely have the best marriages on the planet. And if we would, sometimes I feel like, to your point, we hyper-focus on the marriage passages, and we should know them. We should know them. They're the revealed word of God to us. We should absolutely know them. But my problem generally in my marriage is not that I don't know the marriage passages well enough, that I've not exegeted them in the Greek. It's that it's all the other verses about what it looks like to have the fruits of the Spirit and walk away from the deeds of the flesh. That's my problem. That's my problem.
And
I completely agree. It's I wouldn't put it in print, but any passage in the Bible is a marriage passage, you know, because to love one another or to honor one another, to forgive one another, those are all we would do in marriage. So,
yeah, like one example that sometimes that I'll talk about is everybody hyper focuses on 1 Corinthians 7 verses 1 through 5 about the duty or obligation of sex within marriage. And then I'm like, okay, let's fast forward to the same letter, 1 Corinthians 13. You know, like, what is Paul describing there in terms of what love looks like? And why is that not applying to how we treat each other in the bedroom?
Yeah.
So that's an example. But I would ask you, John, you know, there are some people who are like, yes, let's get rid of the marriage passages. You know, I'd rather just focus on Philippians 2 and 1 Corinthians 13. What are we missing if we got rid of Ephesians 5 and 1 Peter 3 and other passages that speak specifically to marriage?
Well, we would lose what God really had intended for us. And so you pick any of those passages, Julie, that you just mentioned. You mentioned, how about Matthew 19, that the covenant that I make with Pam is not just me. So a lot of times in a non-Christian marriage, or even in Christian marriages, a lot of times we think, well, I like them, they liked me, so therefore we got married. Well, actually, in a Christian marriage, Jesus says that what he joins together, right? What he and the Father join together, we're not to separate. So it's not just Pam and I signing a marriage license with someone else who was a witness to that, that God somehow is joining us together to make a covenant. And so it's not a pragmatic move that I made with another individual. It's a spiritual covenant that Pam and I have made that we're not to break. And so that frames what we're doing and a whole lot more or in terms that are so much richer than you do for me. And, you know, and then I will do for you, and we'll have fun until we don't. And then we move our separate ways. So, we would miss out on what God's supernatural revelation to us, his good gift to his children. This is what marriage is about, guys. This is what I intended. When you give a gift to your kids, you want them to use it the way that that you intended them as a good gift giver to use. And we would miss out on that.
So I
am like all about that, Julie. I just say I have some of the most miserable marriages I've seen. It's as if the only passage they have in their Bible is Ephesians 5, and they just obsess over it, you know. And that's where I say, hey, let's look at Galatians 5. Let's look at some of the, that's what I said, the fruits of the Spirit. You know, what would happen if we just focus there? I bet you'd have a much better marriage. So that's all I mean by that.
Well, even when you look at the church in general, we tend to have all this controversy around Ephesians 5, and there's a time to debate and have discussion and what does this mean and how can it be abused. But there's also a time to say, hey, maybe we're missing the forest for the trees. And John, because you are a pastor who specializes in marriage, I'm going to expect you to know this verse that I don't know exactly.
Oh, no.
But well, there's
I'm now, it's so funny, Julie. I'm now actually the pastor that helps other people do a marriage ministry. So I work with marriage pastors.
Okay. All right. So here we go. Let's see if you know this one. I don't know it exactly, but it's a marriage verse that we often don't talk about because it's in the Old Testament. But I think it's a beautiful one, and it's in Malachi. And it talks more specifically about this mystery of this covenant that God joins together with his spirit. Do you know what I'm referencing?
Well, it's when he's talking about divorce in Malachi 2. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the parts that I remember off the top of my head is, you know, that he hates it, that it's a violent act, and he's basically leveling charges against, you know, his people. And one of the strongest charges he has is that they're divorcing. And they ask, you know, if I remember the passage right, why, God, why aren't you listening to us? And why? Mm-hmm. He's like, well, because you're not, you're divorcing each other. That's why. Like this, that's not an arbitrary decision you've made. You're basically thumbing your nose at my revealed will. And that's why, you know, if you're looking for an answer, like, how did this happen? How did we... In some respects, a theologian wouldn't be comfortable with this language, but how do we get on the outs with God? Well, you were divorcing each other. So part of the passage that I remember.
And I just looked it up really quick so I could read it because I just think the language in it is just so revealing. So he is answering that question, like, why have you broken favor with me? And he says, it's because the Lord is the witness between you and the wife of your youth. You've been unfaithful to her, though she is your partner. The wife of your marriage covenant, has not the one God made you? You belong to him in body and spirit. Mm. And what does the one God seek? Godly offspring. So be on your guard and do not be unfaithful to the wife of your youth. And boy, I just, you kind of hear echoes of 1 Corinthians chapter 6 in there, but there's something spiritual about marriage.
Absolutely.
And it is a mystery. We can't quite put our finger on it, but but there's something unique about marriage that sets it apart from every other human relationship.
Yes.
So, all right. So all of that is a setup, and it was an important setup to some practical questions of how do we work on our marriages and why is this so foundational? And, you know, John, you and I both know couples who are so busy raising their kids and doing ministry and working and just trying to make ends meet that for years, it just marriage is on the back burner. Mm-hmm. And there seem to be so many more important things. So talk to that couple that really needs to be convinced that they need to be investing.
Yeah. Wow. We just rattled off about 10 different verses already. Yeah. So all of that, go back and look up all of those. That would be a great start. You know, again, it's what Christians should do. It's a proper response. Malachi said, we are the Lord's and we do, you know, as your little children would say, he's the boss of us. And so we do what he says. And so that would be one. It would be a stewardship, the gift that Proverbs 18:22, you know, it's for men, but it would cut the same for women. You know, he who finds a wife finds a good thing. It's a good gift. You've been given favor from the Lord. There are several single people who would love to be married. They would love to be married. They're praying that that's the case, and probably some of them will. But I've been given a gift that they haven't yet, that they desire, and it would be such a poor stewardship of that gift to not take full advantage of it, to not invest in it, to not steward that really, really well. So that would be one. And then another one I would say is that we'll just enjoy it. We'll enjoy our marriages more if we invest in them and we tend to them. And so do you have a second for a quick story that's a metaphor that Pam and I use in our marriage? Years ago, we were traveling up in Vancouver Island. Have you ever been there before off the coast?
It's beautiful.
Yeah, the Bouchard Gardens is where people normally mm-hmm. go. Not a garden guy, not a flower guy, but it's pretty amazing. So we were there. I think we were there to see that and a couple other things with some friends. And we have this thing about just kind of chasing down really obscure landmarks when we're there. So we're looking for this little stone house that was on some map. Can't find it. I'm parking the car. We're looking at paper maps back in the day. And we off to the corner of my eye, I see this garden that is an individual's home. And there's a garden there that looks like the Bouchard Gardens. If they shrunk that thing down and put it in somebody's yard, that's what it looked like. And it was absolutely stunning. It was stunning. And so I got out of the car, stood on the fence, and pretty soon Pam and our friends came out and looked at it. And we're just standing there just like really in awe of this garden. The couple came out and said, hey, would you, you know, they talked to us and they said, would you like a tour? We'd love one. They walked us around this garden and it was very apparent that this was a major part of this couple's life, was just tending to this flower garden that wrapped all the way around their house. And at one point, it was so funny, the woman stopped and she said, it was like, she was like just in shock. How long have you guys been up here? We said, I think maybe 10 days in the Pacific Northwest. She goes, well, who's taking care of your garden? And so mm-hmm. we laughed and we said, nobody is. And and we laughed and I, you know, I think I said, that's why mine looks the way that it does. And that's why yours looks the way that it does. Because you're out here working it all the time. And we got back in the car and just thought, what a great metaphor of marriage. And that a flower garden, we don't have a wraparound garden. We just have those little ones in front of our house. But ours looks the way it does because of the amount of work that we put in. We enjoy it based on the amount of effort and work that we put into it. And so this couple loved, they were so proud. It gave them so much joy. And, you know, at the time, our garden didn't give us a whole lot of joy. We weren't really proud of it, but we weren't confused about why we weren't. It was because we hadn't put any effort into it. And so just like a flower garden, our joy in it is a perfect reflection of the amount of work we put in it as well as the state of it. I think our marriages are too. Pam and I have found that the effort we put into our marriage, the intentionality we put into it is probably one of the best correlations we have to how much we enjoy it. And if you have little kids, it's a little bit different than to be an empty nester. You know, if all your kids' college were paid for, your health was amazing, you had stacks of cash and you're retired. Well, that might look a little bit different than four kids clamoring on you. And yet I still think you can find ways to invest in your marriage there. So yeah. long one, but that one, sometimes we go, if we don't absolutely love our marriage, it's what do we have to do? Like what to tend to our garden to get to the place that we love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, boy, that's a good word picture. And even when you talk about that empty nester, who, you know, has all these things, you know, like money in the bank and health, and because it's like, hey, we've been chasing their careers, or, you know, we've been trying to get our kids in the Ivy League schools and getting them into all these different activities, and there are trade-offs. So, you know, you want that good marriage when you get to the empty nest, but sometimes on the road there, we're so busy with other things that take away from tending the garden of our marriage. And that's where most people live. So, mm-hmm. you know, this conversation is not to add condemnation, but it's encouragement and small steps. So I know that you at your church have had a huge part in Reengage. Mm-hmm. And that's a course that a lot of churches around the country are using to help couples invest in their marriage. But can you talk about some of the basics, like some of the first steps that you would encourage couples to take if they're at the place where it's like, yeah, you know, like we wish our garden were better. We are not tending it as we should be.
Yeah. The principles there are just rallying around God's word, God's spirit, and availing ourselves to the wisdom of God's people over time. And so I would find a church that would preach and believe the gospel, has a high view of marriage, and just ask them what is it that they can do? What can you be a part of? What can you jump into that, you know, you can over time? Not look for some amazing power encounter, one sermon that's going to fix everything. You just want to be in a community that values marriage and that, you know, kind of like, I don't know if you have any of those like super fit friends, Mm-hmm. I find when I spend time with my friends who are super fit, I work out more. I run a little bit longer than I would have. I eat a little less, you know, sugar than I just by virtue of being around them. So I'd find some other people who value marriage and then do whatever uniquely would give you life. Do whatever uniquely would work in your season of life. So we talked about with the little kids. I remember, you know, Pam and I have had a rhythm of trying to date on a regular frequency, you know, during the week and month, and then once a year doing a getaway of some kind. And we've said, hey, if we're going to cheat, you know, if the kids don't have the nicest whatever or our cars aren't whatever, we're going to cheat all that and we're going to invest in us because, you know, our kids will leave us and we love them and we want to see them. We want to see grandkids, but they're going to leave us and we're going to be left with each other. So let's cheat in, you know, other areas, but not ourselves. And so we've always invested. We've tried to anyway. But when our kids were little, we had to make a choice. We had enough money to either eat or have a babysitter, but we couldn't do both. And so truly, I was in seminary and we were just trying to make it go. And so every Monday night, we had our date night and we would put the kids down early. You know, I'd probably come home and make them run wind sprints in the back and, you know, just get them tired. We'd put them down. And that was just our time. It was kind of a, you know, quote unquote, sacred time. We would order food that we didn't have to cook and we would just sit there. And mm-hmm. if there was things we needed to talk about, we would wait until Monday, which meant if you were frustrated on Wednesday, you probably would forget by Monday. So there's a lot of stuff we never brought up on Monday. And we just reminded each other that we loved each other. And but it was so not exciting. It was so not worthy of any Instagram picture, truly. You know, just here we are again on Monday night, you know, at our broken down table at the end of a long day, you know, with our very average meal. Like no one posts that on Instagram, but it was those investments, you know, now that we're enjoying and that we're really, really grateful for. We're able to do other things now, but we never gave up even when things were really, really hard. But we weren't writing each other 3-page love notes every day, you know, or mm-hmm. bring her flowers 4 times a week. We were trying to get by and stay alive and keep it all the plates spinning, but we still found most times when we were at our best, we found times to invest in each other. And I'm really grateful that we did.
Mm-hmm. John, we hear from so many women who are investing in their marriage. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, not always, it is women who are going to pick up the marriage book, are going to say, hey, let's do the re-engage at church. And their husbands are hesitant. First of all, can you explain why that is often the reaction of men?
Well, no, but I can give you a guess. You know, males are humans and humans don't like to look dumb, feel less than, be perceived as in the one down position or stupid or anything like that. Right. So I think relationships probably, I don't know, I'd get in trouble for this, but they might come easier to women. You know, a guy would be more comfortable if the contest was bench press. Guys, mm-hmm. I would do that. But relationships are something that I don't always feel as adequate about. So if you're going to put me in a position where I might be exposed or not feel adequate, not feel like I'm a subject matter expert, that might be something that we would gravitate away from. That would be a reason. And so, you know, I think just being really, really gracious, being grateful for any moves that you see, asking, I've seen a lot of wives kind of come, it's binary. It's, I want to do this thing or nothing else. And I would, you know, because males are human, people tend to champion that which they help to create. And so if he says, I absolutely will not go to re-engage, and you can say, okay, well, great. Is there anything you would do? You know, is anything that would be fun to you? Or if we're going to invest in our marriage, do you have any ideas? Or could I lay out some several different ones? And you pick the one that you'd have the most energy for. And so they don't feel like they were boxed in and forced into something. They felt like they chose to do something rather than they were berated until they capitulated. That would be a thought. And then I would just, you know, I would always go long on encouragement before you just pointed out all the negatives. And then not always, but sometimes working on the marriage can be contagious. And so I would continue to invest in your marriage, even if they don't. But yeah, those are a couple thoughts. What would you add to that, Julie?
Yeah, well, I can't really speak to the men in terms of what's motivating them. But I do think what I hear sometimes is that men feel like they're a project, like their wife wants to fix them. And so, oh no, here's another book or class that's going to tell me everything I'm doing wrong as a husband, which nobody would want. I wouldn't want that as a wife. And in general, women tend to have more vocabulary around these issues and to be more aware of maybe where the marriage isn't as strong. And so I just wonder if guys sometimes feel this knee-jerk reaction of, I'm going to go somewhere and be told all the things I'm doing wrong.
Yes.
And that's not fun.
Yeah. Or even not valuing what it means to be a man, you know, so that's the old joke is that, you know, hey, come to our marriage class, men, where we will beat you up and make you feel bad for not being and thinking like a woman, you know, and rather than honoring some of the best parts of just men and masculinity and, you know, a desire to protect a family or things like that, or just, you know, celebrating and not trying to make them someone that they're not. And also, mm-hmm. I just think the encouragement too, I would just tell you, Pam absolutely has pointed out things about me, about the way I relate to her, to the kids, to others, to God. She's, you know, that first Thess 5:14, she has admonished me and rightfully so. But a couple other words in that same passage, is to encourage, the faint hearted and, to help the weak and to be patient, with all men. And so it's okay to, I think at times to point out, here's the gap between what is and what I think should be. But, you know what, there's some things you're doing that I'm really grateful for, and I want to encourage you. You will get a lot of mileage out of those things. I'm more motivated to be a better husband when Pam encourages me, as opposed to pointing out my faults, things like that. And there's absolutely a place she needs to point out some areas that I could do better in. But I find myself really motivated when Pam says, "I'm grateful I'm married to you." Some of the things that we want in marriage, maybe. We might get a little bit more mileage if we encourage. That's all. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So can you talk to the man who's listening? Like, what would you say to him? I mean, just in terms of, you know, we've been talking a lot to women, like, here's how you can encourage your husband. What about that man who is hesitant to get in a marriage group or read a marriage book, that sort of thing?
Okay. Well, let me appeal to self-interest, which oftentimes is pretty powerful. So there is a book that I actually would commend to men. It's called From Strength to Strength. Have you read that, Julie?
I have not.
Arthur Brooks. But what he's talking about is the second half of life. So he's a man, so he's talking, you know, kind of to men, but it would apply to both men and women. And he talks about what makes a rich and happy life at the end. And so oftentimes the first half of a man's life he's trying to achieve or to accumulate or things like that. And if he stays on that same path, that same treadmill, he will have to work exponentially harder to get the same results. And he will find himself very, very frustrated. Now, what will happen is it just happens. We're not as, we don't have as much energy. You know, we've got so much stuff in our brains. We don't have an automatic recall, you know, those kinds of things. But what we do have is wisdom. And so we should look for ways to kind of leverage that wisdom. That's a big thrust of it. But the other part is what makes men have happy, fulfilling, satisfied lives. And most of it is actually relationships. And it's a relationship with their spouse. And it's a relationship with a few close friends. And what happens is guys will continue to keep trying to fill the void with accomplishments and achievements, and they'll be really, really frustrated at the end. And it's pretty common for a man, you know, in his 60s, 70s, and 80s and go, I would redo this all again, knowing what I know now. And so that book go interview 10 men in their 80s and ask them how they wish they would have spent their life. And the thoughtful ones, the ones that are really happy would say, I invested in my marriage. I would have given it a little more time. You'll be glad toward the back half of your life that you invested in relationships. So you can start no matter how old you are, but like anything, there's a compounding interest that accrues if you start early. And that's what I would say. There's lots of reasons, but you'll be glad you did. Rather than beat you up, I will just tell you that I think you will be glad. And statistically, if you're familiar with that, you know, that really long-term study from Harvard and things like that, that's men who are happy. It's relational, not accumulation or accomplishments.
Yeah. Nobody ever says, boy, I wish I didn't invest so much time into my wife and children or friendships. Right. So that's good wisdom. One more question, John. There are some couples who are hearing what you're saying and they're like, man, I wish I had followed this advice 20 years ago when we first got married. But now I don't want to spend time with my spouse. Like there's so much gross there and conflict that, you know, I don't even know where to start. Like, I just feel like we just have to give up.
Well, when I doubt God, his goodness, his reality, those kinds of things, one of the things I run to the most is just given the seat that I've sit in, seeing the turnaround marriage stories where it's as bad as what you said and even worse. The divorce papers are actually drawn up and they're in hand. So in Reengage, you know, it's a 14-lesson curriculum, 14 weeks, and then at the end, normally we'll do a celebration night. And one of my favorite parts of that night is seeing couples come with divorce papers in hand and they tear them up. And they said, we were literally actively in the divorce proceeding process and we've decided absolutely we're not going forward and we want to give this thing a go. And so I've seen everyone, there's a lie that you've crossed a line that you can't get back from. And there's a lie that no one else has had it as hard as you've had or it's been as bad as you have. Now, and I don't know your situation if I'm talking to you, but I will tell you, I've seen literally thousands and thousands of couples that I think the world would have bet against that are now happily married. And I think, you know, that's that famous University of Chicago study that couples, they just decided to kind of stick it out, that were teetering on divorce. And the magic secret sauce was they just didn't get divorced. That's how what was the one thing? They didn't quit. That's why they're still married. And the inverse correlation, if you know that study, Julie, the best part of that study was the more distressed a couple was on the other side, the happier they were. And so it's almost like there was that pain had caused them to go, we're not going back there. And so I would say, don't give up. I would say, look for some small tangible steps. And you do have to believe that you actually could have a better marriage. And I would get close to some people who have good marriages. I would get close to a church that had categories for people not being perfect and have made mistakes and being in need of God's grace. And just take the next wise step.
Well, there you have it. I love that after all of his years in ministry, rather than feeling bitter or disappointment, John is still hopeful and still certain that even very difficult marriages can make it, and that marriage is really worth fighting for. I hope you feel encouraged and inspired and that you have discovered some practical ways to work on and improve your marriage. If you're a church leader or just someone looking for resources to help build your own relationship, we've linked to the Reengage curriculum in the show notes, along with some other resources on this topic. Well, that's it for now. Thanks for joining me, and I look forward to having coffee with you next time on Java with Julie.